Yeah.
How much did it cost you, what is it, your express?
$123.
Wow.
But it wasn't express, it was regular air.
Regular air.
Express means they guarantee it.
Yeah.
To be there at a certain
point. And that had to have been a, as much as just bringing it, isn't it?
What do you mean? I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that.
If it was express, it would have cost as much as just bringing it on the plane, $260,
oh,
wouldn't
it? It's a little bit under that.
Oh, brother. But still that high.
Yeah.
To keep it open a little longer.
Right.
This is hazy enough, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
$35,000 camera?
No. No. $35,000 camera will cost you $1,000 a day to rent. Just the camera.
$1,000 a day to rent? Which camera? How much is that one?
$5,000.
$5,000?
Yeah. It's a cheap one.
You must always tell the truth, but you'll get it exactly right.
Okay, David, anytime you're ready.
Okay. All right, I think I'll go through these questions sort of the way I've got them here. The first question I'd like to ask you concerns the impact of the Tet crisis of 1968 on Johnson's decision not to run again. And if you would say something about Tet, both psychologically and in a military sense, and incorporate this question in your statement.
I don't really believe that Tet and the aftermath of Tet had anything much to do with President Johnson's decision. I come to that conclusion both from my experience at the time and from things that I learned of very solid character since leaving government. At the time, he had made it clear to a group of us, once at a Tuesday lunch, once at the cabinet table, in the autumn of 67, that it was most unlikely that he would run. When Westmoreland was back in November of 67, he asked Westmoreland, and I knew this, whether if he did not run, it would be understood by the men in the field. In other words, would it affect morale? And Westmoreland said, no, I believe they would understand. I think that that probably was the last checkpoint in his decision. Now, what I learned afterwards was that he had almost not run in 64, and probably was that reason, and made a rather firm decision, which is incorporated in a letter written by Mrs. Johnson at the time, that he would announce sometime early in 68 he would not run. And there were good reasons for that, which I don't have to go into, but I would say that from all I know, the decision was 95% made long before Tet.
One of the things that we've run into again and again, of course, is this notorious phrase, credibility gap. And I wonder if you would say something about your estimate as to what caused this credibility gap and whether anything other than the Tet crisis in 68 could explain why that was given so much currency.
The credibility gap, I believe, had its origins much earlier. As a phrase, I don't know who first used it, but I believe it was used as early as 66. And I think that it, in the writings about this period, it is related to the allegation that President Johnson did not level with the Congress in 1964 when he laid before it the Southeast Asian resolution, in the context of the attack of the PT boats in North Vietnamese. And the allegation is that the Congress passed the Southeast Asia Resolution on misapprehensions as to its meaning. I think that anyone who takes the trouble to read the text of the Congressional Record at that period can perceive that Congress knew exactly what it was doing. Senator John Sherman Cooper played an extremely important role at that time in making sure the Congress did by underlining what they were doing constitutionally, which was they were acting on that clause in the CETO Treaty, which demanded that the constitutional procedures of the government be carried out before the treaty could come into effect. And both the press at that time and the reading of the Congressional Record will show that there was no misapprehension. I don't like to impute motives to other people because I've lived long enough to know that I don't necessarily understand the motives of other people. But it seems to me possible that some people who later changed their minds came to believe that they didn't understand the situation in 64. Now, there was I don't know whether it'd be a credibility gap, but there certainly was a massive difference in the judgment about Tet and its meaning inside Southeast Asia, both militarily and politically, in the media of the United States, and the judgment in the government. And when President Johnson made his evaluation in the press conference after Tet, shortly after Tet, which incidentally holds up extremely well in light of history, people may have said, it's so different from the media that they may have re-evoked the credibility thing. But I do believe that as a matter of history, the notion that Johnson was involved in some sort of credibility problem antedates Tet.
We've heard from some of the people we've interviewed that a real problem was Johnson's eagerness to discover progress in Vietnam, and he ordered Westmoreland home and in effect told Westmoreland to go around and make show progress statements, and Westmoreland and Press Club, November 67, particularly spoke out. And I wonder if you think, as others do, that Johnson made a mistake in telling his commander in the field to come home and show progress, and Westmoreland was perhaps not so sure there was progress at hand.
Oh, I don't think for a moment that Westy doubted that there was progress. He brought home both Ambassador Bunker and General Westmoreland to give honest evaluations of the progress that had been made, and there's no doubt that there was enormous progress in 66, 67. In fact, the whole Tet Offensive, if you study the captured documents, was based on the Hanoi's appreciation of how much progress had been made. There is, however, embedded in this question, a real issue. I think Westmoreland made an impression. I think Bunker made an impression. And President Johnson, in probably his most effective press conference ever, in which he wore a lavalier mic and talked with great freedom in a press conference, he underlined that the progress was limited. Using his arms, he said, the progress has not been like that. It's been like that, slow. And that was wholly credible, and it happens to be true. But at just this period, Hanoi was cranking up for a maximum effort, which turned out to be the Tet Offensive and the April Offensive, which got lost in the shuffle. So that the problem that arose was that while great emphasis was given, and properly, to the credible accounts of General Westmoreland, Ambassador Bunker, and the President, the people were not prepared for the Tet Offensive fully. And President Johnson, in his book, and General Westmoreland, in his book, say that they made a mistake in not saying much more dramatically than they did that they expected a maximum enemy effort early in the year in response to the prior progress. So there is where we got whipsawed, and that I think was a major problem, and I do believe that President Johnson should have used the occasion, the State of the Union message in January, which came before Tet, to say roughly what he had said in December to the Australian government on the occasion of Prime Minister Holt's services. He went out there after Prime Minister Holt. Crown. Because he gave an Australian cabinet in my presence, notes on it, very full briefing on the forthcoming offensive. And if he had said, now we've made immense progress, the enemy's going to make a maximum effort, which is what he told him. And when we set it back, we may have some chance for peace, but it's going to be we're going to see kamikaze tactics, we're going to see a very hard winter. Just exactly what he told the Australians. If he'd said that to the American people, I think that history might be a bit different. And I think that he acknowledged that as a failure, so was General Westmoreland.
Well, for a guy that was so concerned with media and who's having such daily troubles with trying to sell his policies, do you have any explanation for why he made what, in retrospect, seems like a real error of not selling hard enough?
It was not preparing people hard enough. I suspect it comes from an inhibition that politicians have toward high responsibility. In this case, I think a quite inappropriate inhibition on revealing to the enemy what you know. Now, he let Westmoreland... it was General Wheeler who gave a speech at the Detroit Economic Club, talking about, we're about to have an Ardennes-type of offensive. I was briefing people. General Westmoreland was briefing people. The military correspondent, the senior military correspondent in Washington of the New York Times did a series, Saigon alert. But it never could break through the consciousness of the people unless the president had done it. And I do regard that as a major error.
In a sense, a follow-up question, and I think it's worth your saying this in a simple way, even though you wouldn't want to claim having originated the idea. Clearly, Tet 68 was an overwhelming military disaster for the North Vietnamese.
And political disaster. The Tet was both a military disaster for the North Vietnamese and a political disaster. It was a military disaster because they lost a very high proportion of the North Vietnamese regulars and an astonishing proportion of the Viet Cong, who were given what turned out to be the not very attractive job of going into the towns and cities where they were decimated and have never recovered to this day. Part of the reason that South Vietnam is to this day ruled on a carpetbagger basis by North Vietnamese is that the communists in the South were always a small minority. But they never recovered from Tet. So it's a pure North Vietnamese administration, South Vietnam. And politically, the ability, the fact that the people in the cities refused to enter into an uprising against the government, as the VC had been promised. The fact that everyone fought well, that the North Vietnamese got into Hue, but were thrown out of Hue by South Vietnamese, not Americans. That the whole government had to galvanize itself to deal with the destruction of the cities. All left a much stronger regime in South Vietnam after Tet and before, a more confident people, and a very seriously set back communist military establishment. So there's no doubt in what the outcome was. Now, what your question is again?
In a sense, a follow-up question is, why was it that the American people never understood during Tet 68 that this, in fact, was a military disaster for the North?
I think it was not understood as a military disaster for the North, partly because the reasons for the offensive and the expectation on our side that it was coming was not made clear, and that was one element. But secondly, it was never properly reported. The reporters there, they'd all been briefed. Barry Zorthian had released to the press documents indicating precisely what was going to happen, but still in their hearts and minds, to use a familiar phrase, they did not really take it in that they were going to see quite a show, a maximum effort. And when it happened, they focused on the most dramatic bits that they could send back in their cameras. And perhaps as press tend to do, in that sort of situation, they were a bit skeptical of the American military and skeptical of the argument, and may have had a certain amount of pleasure in seeing them temporarily discomfited. I don't regard that as wicked. You know, that's normal press attitude. In any case, the nature of the communist offensive was never explained. The nature of their military defeat was never explained. And the nature of their political defeat was never explained. In fact, my old friend Bill Fulbright, and I do regard him as an old friend despite our differences, and we have many things we've agreed on. After I had been given a briefing, I think out in Palm Desert, to this effect, after Tet, got up in the floor of the Senate and said, well, the White House staff must now be mad to take this view. Well, that is the historian's view, and it was perfectly clear if you professionally followed what preceded what happened and the date of the moment. But it never got through, and I think that was largely a rather grotesque failure of the media, with some contributing factor from our administration, because we did not adequately prepare either the press or the media. We prepared the media some, but it didn't take. We didn't prepare the people, however, for this maximum effort in which we battened down the hatches for some months.
We've heard a lot about the impact of television, and one of the things that Peter and I have discovered is again and again, a disaster image is always going to be more appealing and be more dramatic than trying to photograph something like flowers. And do you think that the fact that the media would have to report disaster initially would help explain why Tet ended up being perceived as a disaster? Or is there some other explanation?
I think television played a part, but I think you've got to put it in perspective. Scotty Reston with the New York Times once, when I chided him for not reporting some positive developments in Latin America, told me, in a phrase he later used in a foreign affairs article, that even the New York Times had a police blotter mentality. The tendency of the press, I guess, since a press existed, to report disaster and underreport constructive developments is something that is built in the mentality of the press, and it may be the mentality of readers. Perhaps it's more exciting to have conflict, bloodshed, disaster, than, as you say, to see the slow constructive development of things like flowers growing. Now, so that I think that all the way back to George Washington, all the way through the Spanish-American War, the media have been an extra dimension that heightened tensions and so on in our political life. Television, as it has been used, has simply heightened that old tendency in the media. Because to photograph something that's happening or alleged to be happening, you know, some of the Buddhas burn themselves up as media events very cleverly. They knew they'd get around the world television, and people thought they were a lot more important in the political life south of the world. So there's a tendency here to look for the most dramatic picture rather than to get a balanced portrait on film of what's going on. And I think that it tends to happen with the press in general, except for a handful of rare correspondents, but it's even more true of television.
Let's talk for a second about, briefly, about
David, let me change things.
Okay.
Later than 3:15.
Yeah, we'll be through.
Oh, I see inside. Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be through here in just a few minutes. We want to ask the caisson questions inside. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, David.
All right. We want to talk about the General Loewen photograph. This morning you mentioned that really it hadn't had much impact on you. If you could say something about what you remember from the photograph when it came out and whether it had any impact on you, that would be fine. As we mentioned this morning, some people thought of it as a symbol that if General Loewen could kill someone in cold blood on a Saigon street, our South Vietnamese allies certainly weren't representatives of any democracy.
General, the famous picture of General Loewen shooting a VC, captured VC in the street, struck me as a highly emotional act, but understandable in the context. The context was that the VC had come into Saigon in substantial numbers and were trying to stimulate an uprising. The fighting was all over town. The reason the police were involved and the reason General Loewen were involved was that, contrary to communist expectation, the people of Saigon had not risen in revolt against the government. They were turning people in, and they were fighting, and the local militia, civil servants who had guns, were fighting the communists. So the fact that if you captured a man in that sort of intense urban civil war context and shot him in that highly irregular, intense circumstances did not strike me as an act of wickedness. It's an act of, a very sad act, but an act of war in that context. Now, without knowing who Loewen was or what the police were up against at that particular time in the Battle of Saigon, I can understand that it could be misinterpreted by others, but that was my judgment.
We've talked in interviews with, and I think of Harry McPherson as being particularly outspoken on this subject, a problem in a sense of dissension within the administration itself. On the one hand, official reports coming from Vietnam. On the other hand, television reports. The one reporting military disaster for the North, the other seeming to report military disaster for the United States. Can you say anything about why some administration people would have found the television reporting somehow more truthful, McPherson feels this, than what you could get from this vast apparatus in the White House Situation Room?
Well, I can understand that people who were not professionally following the engagement and hadn't, you know, been embedded in that problem by the accidents of their job and history would take that kind of view. There's something else, and I certainly would not wish to relate this to Harry McPherson, who's an old and good friend, or any other individual. But after all, it's only a small part of an administration that bears responsibility for military and security problems. A great many people in an administration like ours, a compassionate administration which is, you know, working with every ounce of its capacity and civil rights and poverty and all the rest, were made up of people whose cast of mind was, how shall I say, anti-militarist. It's a tradition I know well because my parents met in a socialist Sunday school, and they were pacifists by inclination. Perhaps the first song I ever heard was "I Didn't Bring Up My Boy to Be a Soldier," when I was in my infancy. So that I have no trouble understanding with sympathy, even affection, the views of those who regarded the whole affair in South Vietnam as just horrid, and who, you know, would believe television reports rather than the reports of these hardline fellows in the field and so on. It happens, in my judgment, to be the case that they were wrong in their assessments, just technical assessments. And when the weekly reports of the country team are published, which were the most influential single influence on the picture that President Johnson had, they're going to hold up remarkably well because they came with all the warts and they never had a backtrack. as they go through time, they will prove to be a remarkably solid record of what, with hindsight, we know occurred, at least down to the time I left government. But unless you really entered into all of this, I can see, and entered into it professionally, carefully, skeptically, but went into the details, I can easily see that men in the administration charged with other responsibilities would find more credible television reporting of their nice liberal friends than the professional assessments of the administration.
Would you say that you paid very much attention to television reporting of the Tet crisis, or did you find with round-the-clock duties that you never had time to watch the news at a particular time or see a summary later on?
Thereby, the question of my watching television is a minor comic affair of the administration, because I did not really regard it as my duty to follow the television news closely. But President Johnson did, and he would call down and say, did you see Senator X on Today Show this morning? I said, no, sir, I've been busy with something else. And finally, he installed in my office a small three-screen television set, and he said, now, well, I don't want you ever again to tell me that if I call down there, you can't watch it, or you're not watching one of these reports. It's important that you do it. And I do confess that that was one of the orders of the emperor. I did disobey. There's a famous Chinese proverb that says there are some orders of the emperor you must disobey, because I couldn't do my work if I was going to be as obsessed. Now, he was like a sponge in absorbing intelligent news, ticker tapes, television. He'd watch all three of these. But I didn't figure that was what the taxpayer was paying me for, what he needed me most for. I got a perfectly good sense. It wasn't that I was insulated from what the opposition was saying and so on. I followed all of that. But to follow compulsively what was going on in detail, I didn't. I knew how Kasson was reported. I knew how Tet was reported. I knew what the Washington Post and the Times was printing in the other papers. But I didn't treat it as an obsessive major enterprise.
One final question. I ask you to say something about, in retrospect, about this problem of television. Do you think, for good or ill, that television has changed the way that public officials make foreign policy in this country? And if so, in what ways?
I think television has heightened an old existing problem in the country. As I mentioned earlier, President Washington had a dreadful problem with the press on foreign policy issues, you know, on the whole business of the French versus should we love the French more than the British, etc. And his farewell address is mainly addressed to the need for the United States not to have its internal politics corrupted by that kind of debate. And all the way down through, you know, the Mexican War, let alone the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, the press has been this extra dimension. It is a pretty good case for the proposition, although it's been challenged, that the press started the Spanish-American War. Now, television is heightened because it is more vivid and just statistically more pervasive. On the other hand, I don't think too much should be made of it. I think that American citizens, taken as a whole, have a very good judgment if their ultimate information is pretty solid. They'll discount for sensational reporting on one day, but you know, if there's accumulated sense of reality about a problem, they'll begin to react to it. They don't get nearly as excited about a single television broadcast as the commentator does. So that I still have a lot of faith in the judgment of the American people in the face of the media. And I'm sure that the media should be free to do the best job they can do, and that no one should try to control them. But I would say that basically in television you're dealing with a heightened version of a very old problem in democracy.
All right. Let's cut for now.
David?
Excellent.
Yeah.
It's going beautifully. We're all well ensconced here. Why don't you carry on with...